From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, what happened in Iowa as the death of a young woman is being used to make a political statement about immigration and crime, and this just before a major midterm election.
This is the father who just lost a child. And the fact that he's saying, don't use my daughter as a pawn in your game.
Plus, a conversation with Perez Hilton, the controversial celebrity and gossip writer, about fame and regret.
It was almost like Jekyll and Hyde, disassociating myself from the work I was doing. But at the end of the day, I was doing it. It was me. I had to take accountability for it.
And a Latina mountaineer shares what it feels like to stand atop the highest mountains in the world. That and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Last July, a 20-year-old University of Iowa student named Molly Tibbetts put on her gym shoes and went for a run. Molly didn't make it back home that night, and she never showed up to work the next morning. Weeks went by, and Molly Tibbetts' disappearance began to make national headlines.
The search for Molly Tibbetts is growing more desperate. Almost 12 days since she went missing, as authorities increase their focus on Molly's digital footprint and a Fitbit she may have been wearing, her anguished family is still holding out hope.
In an interview with Good Morning America, Rob Tibbetts, Molly's dad, asked his community and Americans all across the country for help.
We can get Molly back. We just have to have somebody call.
The FBI now joining the massive search efforts. Authorities and hundreds of volunteers have been searching big swaths of land, sifting through tall cornfields. So far, no sign of Molly Tibbetts.
We're going to start our show today with the story of the death of one young woman in Iowa, and how this is being connected to something called the myth of the criminal immigrant. More than a month later, Molly's body was found in a cornfield.
The identity has not been confirmed. However, we believe it to be the body of Molly Tibbetts.
At a news conference, authorities announced that 24-year-old Mexican farm worker Cristian Rivera admitted to the crime and that he was working in the country illegally. His lawyer said in an earlier statement that Rivera, in fact, had permission to be in the country. Reporters surrounded Rivera as he was taken into a local courthouse.
Do you have anything to say for yourself? Are you sorry?
And eventually, according to the affidavit, Rivera led investigators to the cornfield where her body was found. Very quickly, President Trump used the story of Molly Tibbetts' death to make a political case for stricter immigration policies.
Molly Tibbetts, an incredible young woman, is now permanently separated from her family. A person came in from Mexico illegally and killed her. We need the wall. We need our immigration laws changed. We need our border laws changed. We need Republicans to do it because the Democrats aren't going to do it.
This isn't the first time President Trump has done this.
It's now a little over a year since Kate Steinle was killed. Last night, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump mentioned her in his speech.
During the 2016 presidential campaign, Trump consistently brought up the 2015 death of Kate Steinle, a California woman who was hit by a stray bullet that was fired by an undocumented immigrant.
My opponent wants sanctuary cities. But where was the sanctuary for Kate Steinle?
The murder and manslaughter charges against the man were eventually dismissed. And, like Trump, when Molly's body was found, right-wing news media turned the story of one woman's death into a story about immigration and crime.
Why was this man in this country? And why are we still asking this question after Kate Steinle?
And if they weren't here, this woman, if the allegations are true, would be alive.
So I hope this is a giant wake-up call. We have to do something to fix this immigration problem because illegal immigration kills Americans. Enough is enough.
All of this rhetoric is resurging just 2 months before the midterm elections in November, as Republicans face an uphill battle to keep control of the House of Representatives. And in the swing state of Iowa alone, Democrats have a chance of gaining two of the 23 seats they need in order to win back the House. And so to talk more about how people in Iowa are reacting and the impact that all of this could have on the upcoming elections, we're joined now by Timothy Hagel. He's a political science professor at the University of Iowa, where Molly Tibbetts was a student. Thank you so much, Professor, for your time. We are talking about a young woman who is no longer with us, and I think we just have to put that kind of front and center. But we're going to be discussing the reaction that people have had in your state, in Iowa, to what has become the clear politicization of her death. So can you tell us, and we're talking generally here, but what is your sense, Professor Hagel, of how people have been reacting towards the fact that it has become politicized?
Well, it varies. You see a different reaction from the people in Iowa versus the people that are maybe outside of Iowa. That for the people outside of Iowa, and of course, President Trump front and center in this regard, that they made a political connection to this. And to jump back to how the University of Iowa in particular thought of it is that there were articles in the college paper here, the Daily Iowan, that talked about how they wanted to remember her for what she did on campus. She was a participant in the Rape Victim Advocacy Program, RVAP, and Dance Marathon, which is a charity event that raises money for children with cancer and their families. They wanted to remember her for those kinds of things rather than anything outside of that.
You know, you had Donald Trump Jr., who recently wrote an op-ed for the Des Moines Register. And he was squarely blaming Democrats for Molly's death and saying that claims about Republicans politicizing her death were, quote, absurd. So I'm wondering, what was the reaction of Molly Tibbetts' family to all of this?
They don't want to see necessarily the death of their daughter, their family member, to be used for political purposes. And so it's understandable their reaction. And Molly Tibbetts' father had an editorial himself where he emphasized those points, that he thought that Molly would not agree with the immigration policies of President Trump. And so for them, it's an odd situation where, you know, maybe the outside politicians, they're not remembering Molly as a person.
You know, soon after Molly's body was found, Iowa's own governor, Kim Reynolds, said this. She said, "Too many Iowans have been lost at the hands of criminals who broke our immigration laws."
Governor Kim Reynolds is defending her statement following news of Rivera's arrest when she criticized the country's broken immigration system.
Then later she told reporters that politics should not be injected into this. Could this actually backfire against her, considering that the governor is up for re-election?
She made that statement, and as you indicated, she backed off. And I think her phrasing was something along the lines of when she was criticized about her initial statement, she said it's about policy, not politics, or phrased it something like that.
It's actually politics that are preventing us from fixing a broken system. It is time for people to put politics aside, to sit down and find a solution to this problem.
She'd sort of stepped into those political waters, then there was an immediate backlash. And I think what may have happened there is that she's initially echoing whatever it was that President Trump or others nationally had been saying. But the immigration issue isn't as big an issue here in Iowa as it is, obviously, for states that have a border, where you have crossings of people coming over. We've had our own issues, maybe aware of the Postville raid from about 10 years ago, and at the time was the biggest raid.
Agents from Immigration and Customs Enforcement raided Postville's largest employer, a food processing plant on the edge of town. 389 immigrants were arrested Hundreds more fled in fear.
And so in that sense, it's not that we haven't had these issues, but still they're of a different character necessarily than what you see in other states. And I think that maybe the governor recognized that, well, this isn't necessarily a road we want to go down, especially given some of the pushback that happened immediately. And so we haven't seen a lot of other politicians, at least locally, look to politicize it.
So this narrative that in a state like Iowa, which is like so central to the national political conversation, you're saying actually that immigration is not one of the issues that actually matters to the voters of Iowa. It's not their main list of things that's going to motivate them to go out to the polls.
And those two things are a little bit different. It's not that Iowans don't think immigration issue is important, but the thing is that it just may not be as high on their list of things, as you say, to get people out to the polls. And it's not that Iowa is a Republican state either, that we've actually gone for, the state's gone for Obama in the prior two elections, 8 and 12, and then went for Trump in 16. So as I would always characterize this as a purple state, even though right now we do have a Republican governor and Republicans control both chambers of Congress, that's very likely to change. It's changed in the past. And in Iowa, the independents, what we call the no-party voters, are actually the biggest group, bigger than Republicans, bigger than Democrats. And so why they turn out and who they vote for is critical to who's going to win. But for a lot of the no-party voters, they're more concerned about what you would call kitchen table issues, the economic things, security of jobs, wages, things of that nature. And those are going to have a higher priority than things like immigration.
So when you step back, how much of an impact do you actually think that politicizing Molly's murder will actually have in the November midterms?
I don't think it will have that much in terms of a political effect. The community is shaken and so forth, but at least locally, it won't become that kind of political issue regarding immigration that maybe some would like it to or some try to make it to at the national level.
Professor Hagel, thank you so much for speaking with us on Latino USA.
You're very welcome.
Timothy Hagel is a political science professor at the University of Iowa. The president and Iowa's governor alike connected Molly Tibbetts' death to the immigration debate. But what exactly is the link, if any, between immigration and crime? And to talk about this, we're joined by Alex Piqueiro. He is a professor of criminology at the University of Texas at Dallas. And we're going to discuss this thing called the myth of the criminal immigrant. Professor Alex Piqueiro, welcome to Latino USA.
Pleasure to be here, Maria.
You've done a lot of research on the whole issue of immigration and crime. So when you saw the story of the murder of Molly Tibbetts, and then the revelation that potentially there was an undocumented immigrant involved, what was your immediate reaction when you saw that?
My first reaction was, it's a tragedy that this young woman died while she was out for a run. That in itself, when someone is murdered, is a horrific event. So that was my first inclination, was to feel compassion for her and her family. It's unfortunate when certain incidences become politicized, whereas others don't. There are a lot of homicides in the United States. Many of them don't get politicized. If they were a regular native-born American, I'd still have the exact same reaction. A young woman died.
Let's pull back from Molly Tibbetts for a minute. For somebody who is like a lay person, right, who's just a consumer of American media, can you help explain this myth of the criminal immigrant?
The myth of the criminal immigrant actually predates, you know, the last 3 or 4 years of our lives in the United States. It actually starts at the beginning of the 20th century. When there were actually senators in Washington who actually were commenting on the immigrants of the early part of the 20th century. And those immigrants were Germans and Jews and Poles and Italians.
If you don't like your Uncle Sammy, then go back to your home or the sea, to the land from where you came.
And so the narrative of this immigrant coming to America and bringing in their problems and social ills is not necessarily a new issue.
Don't bite the hand that's feeding you.
It's an issue that's been around for 120 some years. It's just changing which immigrant group that is. Right now, the focus happens to be on a particular immigrant group, predominantly Latinos, maybe Mexicans, but it also has been immigrants from the Middle East, from Sudan, from other parts of the world.
The data clearly shows that immigrants commit crimes, including serious crimes, at rates that are lower than people who were born in the United States. How is it possible that that data can be so clear, overwhelmingly clear, over years upon years, and that yet the myth of the criminal immigrant has risen to the top?
The science is irrefutable, regardless if it was done 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, in one part of the country. We're using individual level data, using aggregate data of neighborhoods or states, using data from self-report records, from official arrests, for our convictions, by different researchers and different universities and different think tanks. And you could not tell a story where the data are absolutely clear. The thing is that those data do not fit the narrative that some people want to communicate to the public. And therein lies the problem, is opinion without facts is very dangerous. And look, I recognize, Maria, that there people have opinions about things in life that they're very emotional about, that no amount of data is ever going to change their mind. And so I get that. But I do also think that there are people who just don't know these data and don't know what the facts are.
This is a story about the murder of a young woman who was innocent and doing what she loved. It's become a story around immigration and perpetuating a myth. So what are some of the solutions?
I think the solution is something that her dad started last week when he penned an editorial in the Des Moines Register newspaper, basically saying that, and I'm paraphrasing, that his daughter would not want her death to be used for these kinds of political reasons, and that she was someone who did not discriminate against race or ethnicity or immigrant or non-immigrant or whatever. So the fact that he's saying, don't use my daughter as a pawn in your game, I think that that is the clearest signal that anybody can send to American citizens about what this conversation should be about. He is the face now of this unfortunate tragedy, and he has a lot of people behind him that can empathize with the fact that this man just lost his daughter. And I think that people will rise above political narratives and hatred and vilifying certain groups, and they will support this person, and they will support what it is to be an Iowan, what it is to be an American.
Professor Alex Piqueiro, thank you so much for speaking with us on Latino USA.
It was an honor to be with you, Maria.
Alex Piqueiro is the Ashbel Smith Professor of Criminology at the University of Texas at Dallas. Coming up on Latino USA, a different story, a look into the story of Chinese migrants in Mexico. Stay with us, no te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Rockefeller Foundation, promoting the well-being of humanity throughout the world since 1913. More about Rockefeller's work in food, health, power, jobs, and resilient cities at rockfound.org. And the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, whose Clinical Scientist Development Awards support promising early career physician scientists and their research efforts to improve human health.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And distrust towards immigrants is not, in fact, by any means, an exclusive trait of the United States. Latin America has its own often complex immigration history. Chinese immigrants in particular have frequently faced discrimination as they set up lives and businesses throughout Latin America. Jason Oliver Chang is a researcher and assistant professor of history and Asian American studies. And he stumbled upon the history of one Latin American Chinese community while he was studying the U.S.-Mexico border. Then Chang spent several years working to uncover the story of Chinese migrants in Mexico for his new book, Chino, Anti-Chinese Racism in Mexico, 1880 to 1940. And what he found? Well, it was surprising. I mean, at least for me. Jason Oliver Chang is joining us now, and welcome to Latino USA, Jason.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's awesome to be here.
What you have done in kind of uncovering the history of Chinese in Mexico is really, in many ways, I think, earth-shattering.
Wow.
I really feel that way.
Uh-huh.
So I got to ask you, where does it come from? Was it that you as a kid were going to Mexico? Was it that you, like, what is it that made you say, I want to study the Chinese in Mexico?
Yeah. After my first year at Berkeley's ethnic studies program, I encountered some articles about the Chinese migrating between U.S. and Mexico. And I thought to myself, how can I have spent 10 years of my life studying the border and not known anything about this? Then I started reflecting and I was like, oh yeah, I saw like Chinese restaurants in Nogales. And I remember meeting a Chinese Mexican doctor who ran a free clinic in Tijuana. And I was like, oh, they're there. I just didn't think to ask why or what their experiences were like.
It's almost like you too?
Yeah.
You too bought into the notion of what Mexican national culture and identity is.
Absolutely.
When did the Chinese immigration to Mexico start?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's basically two phases. The first phase begins during Spanish colonization, right, where they're taking gold and silver from Mexican mines, exporting it through Acapulco, and taking it to Manila. And so in that transit, in that commerce, they picked up Filipino sailors, Chinese sailors, Japanese sailors. Many of them would jump ship and leave, and some of them established themselves in Mexico City in this early period. The Trans-Pacific trade, it established the expectation that there was something on the other side over there that was worth going to. That really accelerated in the 19th century. So that's the second phase.
What happens in the 19th century that accelerates the Chinese and Mexico presence?
Mm-hmm. So in the late 19th century, you have growing anti-Chinese labor organizing. And ultimately, this led to the passage of the Chinese Exclusion Acts in 1882, which was one of the first laws that barred immigrants based on race, a racial restriction.
Where do the Chinese end up going?
It's kind of like a balloon, right? It gets squeezed in one area and then expands in another. And so much of that flow that was previously going to the United States shifted and went south to Mexico.
So what were some of the stereotypes?
The stereotype is that they were both very successful economically in business, but also very pernicious. They also gambled a lot and used drugs, opium, and that these were the side effects of having Chinese in your community, is that they would bring gambling and drugs, and that this was something that needed to be held back.
Was the government, in fact, actually pushing these stereotypes?
Mm-hmm. There are organizations that developed across the republic. Each state had their own Ligas Antichinas, and they had...
Each state in Mexico had a Liga Antichina?
Mm-hmm. And their slogan was, United, we will expel the Chinese. So I had to think, why does it make sense to hate the Chinese in this particular moment, right? What were the arguments that people were making against them? And most often, people were expressing a kind of civic call for help. Politicians could expel the Chinese and put on a good face while doing nothing else.
going on for you present day as mm-hmm. you have done all of this research about racism and targeting immigrants and immigrant restrictions and racial hate?
As a historian, there are many things where you encounter that you think should stay in the past. And time again, and since Trump's campaign, I've seen history come back in full force from the attempts to implement the Muslim ban to discussions of building another wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. These arguments over U.S. immigration policy are 200 years old. The populations shift, the discourse is the same.
Jason, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
It's a great pleasure.
Jason Oliver Chang is the author of Chino, Anti-Chinese Racism in Mexico, 1880 to 1940. He's an assistant professor of history and Asian American studies at the University of Connecticut. And now we're going to turn to, well, a very different kind of interview. Mario Armando Lavandeira Jr., a.k.a. Perez Hilton, is perhaps the most well-known celebrity and gossip writer of our time. In the mid-aughts, he became famous, well, some people might say infamous, actually, because of his blog, PerezHilton.com, where he wrote about the latest exploits and scandals of Paris Hilton, Lindsay Lohan, and the like. His signature style also included giving celebrities nicknames that they probably didn't like a lot. Here's a clip of him naming some of these on the Jimmy Kimmel Show in 2007.
Jessica Simpson, you call?
Jugs.
Jugs. Britney Spears is?
She's a hot mess.
Hot mess.
And I call her a lot of other things.
Kirsten Dunst.
Kiki Drunkst.
Perez Hilton was also known for the drawings of genitalia that he would put over the pictures of celebrities that he posted.
What Perez does, and I'm assuming that's not your real name, is he draws penises on people's faces.
But he became truly loathed when he began to out gay celebrities like Neil Patrick Harris and Clay Aiken.
Is that true, the rumor that you are gay?
Ask Clay Aiken.
I'm sitting on the chair where the Gaken sat. Oh, no.
Still, none of this deterred people from flocking to his website with its signature hot pink color scheme. At its peak, it received 7 million views daily. Now, at a time when we have the first, quote, reality television president, it's illuminating to talk to someone who was instrumental in the rise of reality TV show stars, and who, in fact, was part of establishing a kind of bullying rhetoric that's common now, not just in social media, but also in our politics. So today, Perez Hilton speaks to me about his Latino identity, his regrets, and what comes next for the Cuban American infotainer. Thank you for speaking to us on Latino USA.
Oh, I'm so happy to. I'm a fan of the show. It's truly a really special moment for me to be on this with you and to be able to hopefully inform, enlighten your audience as to who I am.
Enlighten. So, Perez, actually, is that a word that you would apply to yourself and to the work that you've done in the past?
In the past, I used to do things a lot differently than I do now. But yeah, I would use that word enlighten even back then, even though I would say I was definitely deluded. But in my mind, I was saying, well, I'm just shining the light on celebrities behaving badly and those that get it right.
Well, let's go back to the beginning.
Sure.
So you grew up in Miami. Your mom and dad, both of them were born in Cuba. And I think that they left Cuba with, like, seriously, nothing. So tell us a little bit about how you remember your childhood.
In many ways, my childhood was the opposite of what it is now. Like, I would say I was not a very active participant in my formative years because my parents were more than just fine allowing the TV to be my babysitter. So since as early as I could remember, when I was young, that's all I would do is just watch television. And I was like a zombie in front of that screen. My childhood, I would say, was very traditional and normal for Miami. And I would also say that it was not easy for me, not because of anything my parents did, but just society as a whole. You know, I was born gay. I've known I was gay since I could remember. And I grew up in a Latino community. I went to an all-boy Jesuit school from 6th grade through 12th grade. And back in the 90s, people weren't out. And I remember vividly 11th grade, my theology teacher said something to us about homosexuality. She said, you know, studies say that one out of every 10 is gay. And I'm like, wow, that's so progressive of her to even acknowledge that. And then immediately afterwards, this teacher said, but you boys are not like other boys. And not only was I struggling with being gay and in the closet, but I also grew up very fat. I would eat my rice and beans and steak, mi picadillo, all of that. And my mom's idea of us being healthy back then was giving me a salad of iceberg lettuce with tomatoes and mayonnaise. That's what she thought was healthy. I've always been just very intrigued, obsessed, fascinated by celebrity and pop culture. And I think I also attribute that to being Latino. My mom was super chismosa, as they say, knew everything about everyone, not just about celebrities.
Wait. We need to stop, because for people who don't speak Spanish, you just threw out a word and people are going to be like, what did he just say? So chismosa.
Chismosa means gossipy. I mean, I remember my mom subscribing to Hola magazine and all of those other Spanish language celebrity magazines. And then when I was growing up, not only would I watch a ton of television, I also would read every single magazine voraciously. Entertainment Weekly, Vanity Fair, GQ, and a bunch of magazines that don't even exist anymore.
So tell me about the name. First thing I want you to do is tell me the name that your mom and dad gave you when you were born.
My birth name is Mario Armando Lavandeira Jr. When it came time to create the character of Perez Hilton, it was 2004, and Paris Hilton was the Kim Kardashian of the day. And the story actually was born in Miami in December of 2004. I had only been blogging a couple of months and I was back home in Miami for Christmas. I noticed this trend, like all of these bars or clubs that we went to when I was going to bars and clubs and a youngster, they had these reserved signs and every place was saying, oh, that's reserved for Paris Hilton. So Paris was allegedly going to be at every place that Christmas break. And then I was like, oh, please, I know what's happening. All of these clubs are just saying that Paris is coming to get buzz, to try to get more people to show up. And I'm like, please, Paris Hilton isn't showing up, but maybe Perez Hilton is. And then I just had a light bulb go off. I kind of love that name, Perez Hilton. Like, I am Perez Hilton.
A character is born and internet madness ensues. Coming up on Latino USA, why Perez Hilton regrets his early tactics. Stay with us, no te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Gruber Family Foundation, supporting NPR's international coverage, covering the trends, moments, people, and movements that drive the world, always with the goal of creating a more informed public, one challenged and invigorated by events, ideas, and cultures, and the Jack Kent Cook Foundation, providing scholarships throughout the nation to exceptionally high-achieving students with financial need from middle school to college. More information about Cook scholarships is available at jkcf.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And when we left off, Mario Armando Lavandeira Jr. had just come up with his pen name, Perez Hilton. It was 2004. Now, at the time, Perez Hilton had just been fired from his job at Star Magazine. He couldn't afford internet service at home, so he posted up with a laptop at a local coffee shop and started to blog. He promoted his site by posting on Friendster and quickly started generating about 20,000 views a month. From there, he eventually amassed a huge following. But while many readers love Perez Hilton's outlandish and often offensive style, a lot of celebrities did not. As we mentioned earlier, he outed several gay celebrities. Singer Kesha said Perez Hilton single-handedly ruined her relationship by leaking private photos. Will.i.am, in fact, punched Perez in the face after Perez called him a gay slur in 2009. So Perez was becoming a household name, but at what cost? You know, this cartoon character, I mean, in many ways, it's like the worst of what American culture is about. And I'm just wondering, like, what did your Cuban family think about what you were doing and all of the attention you were getting?
Well, I know that my family, even back then, was very proud of me for making something out of nothing, even before there was a social media. I started before there was a YouTube, before there was a Twitter, before there was an Instagram. I started a year before there even was a TMZ. So in many ways, like, I am the Latino dream. Back then, I was deluding myself into saying, well, Perez Hilton is just a character. And if you don't like what I'm saying, don't read it. And it was almost like Jekyll and Hyde, disassociating myself from the work I was doing. But at the end of the day, I was doing it. It was me. I had to take accountability for it.
What was it that made you say, wait a second, I've got to become a different version. I want to become right, nicer. I want to talk about redemption. What made you make that turn?
In 2010, in New York, there was this gay college student named Tyler Clemente.
Tyler Clemente is believed to have jumped from New York's George Washington Bridge last week.
Who took his own life as a result of bullying by a classmate who had secretly recorded him being intimate with somebody else. And then shortly thereafter that, there was well over a dozen other gay youths that took their life. So around that time, this journalist, Dan Savage, created this campaign called It Gets Better.
There are 14 and 15 and 16-year-olds watching this video. What I'd love you to take away from it really is that it gets better.
Encouraging adults to make videos letting young LGBTQ youth know that it will get better. And the first day he launched that campaign, I made a video.
I would have loved to have had me around when I was a teenager, because I would have either looked at Perez Hilton and found him extremely annoying or thought he was really cool, but loved the fact that Perez Hilton was able to create something from nothing and become successful.
And the response that I got to that really shook me to my core and made me change everything. Because I thought I was doing something positive. You know, I always thought people understood that in my mind, it was just shtick. You know, it was just a character. I'm just, you know, an entertainer. But people didn't realize that, or people didn't care. And all they saw was the
hurtful things I was saying, I and people's perception of me hopefully has evolved, not drastically, I'm not being unrealistic, but you know, maybe somebody like Joan Rivers. Not everybody liked Joan Rivers, but when she died, there weren't people celebrating her death. I own this. If I were to die today, many people would probably celebrate my death.
Oh my God. How, oh, Dios mío.
It's true.
Whoa. How do you feel saying that?
I know that.
I've never heard in all of the interviews that I've done in my life, I have never heard anyone say that.
Well, that's the truth. It's true. It would happen.
You say now that you've changed how you report on celebrities. You say that you do not out people anymore. You have a no child policy where you will not post pictures of any celebrity's children. You know, but I gotta say, your site, I mean, it's still a lot of Kardashian stuff. So I'm just wondering, do we really, really need more Kardashian news?
Well, what's funny is, I would say in 2017, that whole year, like many Americans, I was unhealthily obsessed with Donald Trump and everything that was happening in our country. Now we're in 2018, almost 2019. And last year, 17, I was like, I'm over the Kardashians, too much Kardashians, Kardashian overload. But now I'm really thankful for them or Paris Hilton or Lindsay Lohan, because to me, it's just a great escape from the reality of the world we are living in. And I think we need that.
Do you? Because, you know, there's a lot of people who say, look, this is the last thing we need is escapism right now. Well, like the last thing we need in the United States of America is for people to be watching, you know, super, super rich people talking about things that seem to have no value or impact in people's lives.
Well, the great thing
about— you're saying, and I'm intrigued, I'm intrigued because you're saying, no, that's important. We need the Kardashians.
What I love about what I do is in between the Kardashians, in between the silliness, I do post things of substance. Like today, there's at least three or four stories on my website about Donald Trump. And I can do that because I'm the boss and I share what I think is important. And to me, I don't even call it an entertainment news site. It's a pop culture site. And politics, social issues, silly cat videos, that's all part of pop culture. And that's not anything new. I've always been political and vocal and fearlessly so.
So I guess just finally, Perez, what is your message now? What is the message of Perez Hilton now?
The message of Perez Hilton is, that's a good question. I would say to entertain and, or not even that, to infotain. I'm an infotainer. I love to get people smiling, to get people talking about a variety of different things. Sharing my life, my family, my kids, my struggles, talking about weight issues, being a human.
Mario Lavandeira, Perez Hilton, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you. Gracias.
Perez Hilton is the writer and the personality behind the celebrity gossip blog, PerezHilton.com. And now to wrap up our show, the story of a mountaineer who climbed several of the tallest mountains in the world. In June, Silvia Vasquez Lavado summited the highest mountain in North America, a mountain named Denali in Alaska.
This is my seventh summit, and I officially have become the first openly gay woman to have reached this milestone.
Denali was Silvia's final trek that she needed to complete what's known as the Seven Summits Challenge, or climbing the highest peak on each of the seven continents, including Mount Everest. And she became the first Peruvian and the first openly gay woman to do so.
Love is love, equality is equality. We're all made equal. And this is actually from somebody that's taken 13 years to make this.
But it all started for her in a very different place. As a victim of sexual abuse,
Silvia began climbing in 2005 as a way to heal and to find her own inner strength. Soon afterwards, she created a nonprofit called Courageous Girls that helps victims of sexual violence through mountaineering. In this edition of How I Made It, Silvia shares what it feels like to stand on top of the tallest mountains in the world.
My first mountain experience was trekking to the base of Mount Everest in October of 2005. And that was really what changed my life. I had never done any trekking before, and I ended up trekking a little too fast, that we made it to the base of Everest in 4 days as opposed to the 8 days that we needed. And I remember I went so fast that my poor trekking guy couldn't keep up with me. So he kind of got altitude sickness and wasn't able to continue on the last day. I think I had the Andean blood kicking in. I had a vision. I needed to be around mountains to connect to this pain that I had from being sexually abused as a little girl. A couple of months earlier, I did a healing therapy and meditation with my mother in Peru, and it was truly powerful. And, you know, as I had the opportunity to get deep into my subconscious, I had this vision of myself after one of the sessions of abuse, kind of shivering as a little girl. And then I saw myself as an adult embracing this little girl. And as we were embracing, that's actually how this whole vision of us walking among mountains kind of continued. And after I was done with this experience, I remember just pondering and being like, wow, I could have taken that metaphorically, but I decided to actually go a little bit more in execution mode. So I figured, well, if I need to bring this pain to somewhere really high, then I should actually walk to the tallest place in the world. So what prompted me to climb the Seven Summits actually, you know, was something that came out of the result of being on base camp. When I saw the sunrise coming between Everest and Mount Napsi, it was so magical and powerful that I promised Everest, I'm like, wow, Everest, you've given me my life back. One day I'm going to come back and attempt to climb to the top. That's when I figured, I'm like, huh, if I need to become a mountaineer, there's this thing called the Seven Summits. That would give me now mountain experience. I figured it would be a big journey. In 2006, I climbed Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. Then in 2007, I did Elbrus in Russia. And then I took a big hiatus and I wasn't doing any climbing. Then in 2014, I climbed Aconcagua in Argentina. And after that, I continued in 2015. I did Mount Kosciuszko in Australia on my way to climb the Carstens Pyramid in Indonesia. So I did two in one. Then I did a Vinson Massive in Antarctica in December of 2015. Then Everest in Nepal in 2016. Everest, of course, was, you know, everything that I had ever dreamed of.
I just summited Everest.
It was just stunning, beautiful, hard, emotional. Coming back to Everest after making a promise was very powerful, to be honest. And then just summiting Denali, you know, this 2018 for me was just beyond special because it was the last one. It also had been the one that had taken me the longest. Denali is a really challenging mountain. If anything, for many of us who are doing the Seven Summits, is the one that is taking 3, 4, 5, 6 times. And it's a very, kind of a very difficult mountain in terms of just the weather conditions. When you get caught up on storms, you know, these storms can last 2 weeks. You know, like I remember, like when we wake up around 4 a.m., we'll be getting ready and, you know, you'll get out and it'll be this, almost this, you know, cold bite that will get into your hands and into your body. And all of a sudden you will start feeling your limbs going numb and you have to do certain things to move your body in order to, you know, get the circulation going. Climb Denali took almost a month for me. And the differentiation that with Everest, in Everest, we had a lot of support. I mean, so the base of Everest, if anything, it's almost like a mini city. as opposed to Denali, in which, you know, for a whole month, you have to constantly live in your little tent. I mean, and for us, it was like I was there with two friends, and you don't take any showers. I forgot to bring a deodorant, and possibly that was one of the most hellish experiences that I had to experience, because after a week, it's impossible to wear that smell. It's a whole month without taking a shower. I was in the shower for about 4 hours when I got back. And at times I would be trying to remember why I even got into the journey. This was my last one, and I kind of was hoping to complete it on this go-around, and having, you know, having had to turn around a couple of times before added a lot of pressure. So the uncertainty started putting a lot of strain in me. And then just summiting Denali, as we got back to the very beginning at the base, it was such a tough journey coming back that I remember when I stepped foot, you know, at the very end, I kneeled down and I cried so hard because I had nothing in me. I felt so empty. I had nothing physically, emotionally, mentally. I remember feeling that I had given everything to the mountain.
Silvia Vasquez Lavado is a mountaineer and the founder of Courageous Girls, a nonprofit that helps victims of sexual abuse through mountaineering. It for today. Latino USA is produced by Miguel Macias, Antonia Cerejido, Andres Caballero, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo, with help from Fernanda Chavarri. We're edited by Marlon Bishop and Sofia Felisa Carr. Our engineers are Ginny Montalvo and Stephanie LeBeau, and we had help this week from the Marketplace Studios in Los Angeles and Drew Justed. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our fellows are Virginia Lora and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. And if you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us on our next episode. And in the meantime, I'll see you on all of our social media. Hasta la próxima. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Marguerite Casey Foundation, Change for Families by Families, and Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at hsfoundation.org.
Hind, the celebrity gossip blog. Why can't I say this?
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries, and working to inspire and enable the next generation of inventors. More information is available at lemelson.org. And the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, bridging the cultures of science and the arts by supporting new books such as Energy, A Human History by Richard Rhodes, chronicling 500 years of energy transitions. This is NPR.